Chapter 9. 2 days later, we got back on a BOAC airliner and headed for New York, where we were allotted rooms in a slightly cheesy hotel just off Times Square, the noisiest, busiest, most crowded acre of seething humanity I'd ever set eyes on. I thought London was cosmopolitan, but what amazed me about Manhattan was the unbelievable variety of faces on the sidewalks. It made Soho look like Cheltenham. And everything was so huge. You look down Park Avenue towards the old Pan Am building, and the scale of the skyscraper so dwarfed Regent Street you felt you were on a different planet. Soon we started rehearsals. No one at the theatre seemed to know much about the show, but we felt relaxed and confident with a long London run behind us and rave reviews from New Zealand, ha-ha. It therefore took us about 2 hours before we sensed something was wrong. We had been casually rehearsing different parts of the show for the benefit of the technical staff when we noticed several shadowy figures moving around in the stalls, having rather loud conversations. This was not rehearsal etiquette. So we asked for quiet while we were running dialogue, but we got none. When we inquired who the interlopers were, we were told the backers, meaning the investors in the show. And apparently they were rattled. Word filtered back to us that the show was too English. A full rehearsal was requested the next morning before we had the chance to have the requisite full technical rehearsal. We pointed out that they could assess the show better if it had been rehearsed properly, but their panic had taken over. We were bewildered. Why had they invited us to Broadway if they knew nothing at all about the content of the show? Nobody can remember what really happened next, because the following few days were so panicky and frenzied that everything became a blur. The investors let it be known that about 25% of the show had to be replaced. That's a whole quarter in the few days we had before opening. I was not so badly affected, as all but one of my sketches, Rigella, were deemed acceptable, but Humphrey, Bill, Tim and Graham had to go into an inspired creative frenzy. We got permission from some Oxford guys called Terry Palin and Michael Jones to use a sketch that they'd written that we'd heard about, where three stooges illustrate various slapstick jokes involving planks and custard pies, while a lecturer explains the mechanics of the jokes, a sketch which finished up later on the Python stage show. Graham remembered an old Footlights wrestling match where one wrestler fails to turn up, leaving the other to fight himself, also to become a standard Python routine. And best of all, Bill, Johnny, Tim and David came up with a wonderful Beatles version of the Hallelujah chorus, which turned into an absolute showstopper. We dug up a few old sketches and quickies from the past, cobbled them all together in a radically new running order in an insanely short period of time, and somehow managed to produce out of our maelstrom of nerves an opening night that received a tremendous reception. It was such an extraordinary achievement, given the time available, that we stood at final curtain, soaking up the applause, but also stunned that we pulled off this theatrical miracle. Our only regret was that we had to admit that the investors had actually helped us to make the show better, bastards. So, off we all trooped to Sardi's, where Broadway opening nights were traditionally celebrated, popped champagne corks, and generally behaved in a very un-English orgy of relief and astonishment and self-congratulation. And then the volume of noise began to fade, ever so slowly at first, and then to a murmur, a hush, and finally, silence. One man with a long, long face was standing in the middle of the room holding up a sheet of newspaper. It was an early, smuggled version of the review of our show in the New York Times. People gathered round and fell silent. The review was not good. In fact, it was pretty dismissive. "The visitors behave," the critic wrote, "as if they are sure that what they're doing, singing, or saying is hilarious, but what emerges seems obvious or purposeless." I've never seen a party poop so effectively. The crowds melted away, and the cast, lost and dismayed us, but surely there will be other reviews that will reflect the audience's enthusiasm, and indeed there were. But we were Brits. We didn't understand. A bad review in the New York Times, in New York, that's spelt D-E-A-T-H. The situation was not recoverable. The next night, the audience was even better. Tremendous, but so what? The decision to close the show in 3 weeks was taken. The best critic in New York, Walter Kerr, wrote a rave review of the show, a second one, to try and keep it alive. It appeared the day after we closed. 24 years later, another New York Times review all but killed off a film of mine. It's not easy to describe the movie's accumulating dimness or to understand what went wrong, the critic wrote, before concluding, "A Fish Called Wanda seems to have turned into a private joke to be enjoyed only by the members of the cast and the crew who made it." Fortunately, this particular enterprise survived this critical mauling and went on to get 3 Oscar nominations. However, things could move very fast in New York, and no sooner was the show declared dead than it was being revived. A Washington Square supper club theatre called Square East invited us to perform the show there, and we reopened just 4 days after we closed on Broadway. It was a delightful, warm, rather classy club where people dined as they watched a shortened version of our performance. And after the usual rushed transfer and rehearsal period, the stage itself was much smaller and the staging of the show much simpler, I discovered, to my surprise, I much preferred performing there to playing at our Broadway theatre. In retrospect, this may seem absurd, but I think it says quite a lot about my attitude to show business. For a start, the strict rules of legitimate theatre did not apply, so I was able to change into my performing outfit in my hotel, walk 20 minutes to the theatre, arrive 5 minutes before the show opened, and more or less go straight on stage without any of the nonsense about makeup. Best of all, the much smaller stage required far less voice projection and allowed a more naturalistic performance, free from the slightly operatic exaggeration of expression and gesture that seemed necessary in a 1,100-seat theatre. It took me a few performances to adapt to this new style, almost by a process of osmosis, and by the time I had, I noticed that I was enjoying doing the show more than I ever had before. This more relaxed mode of comic acting chimed in with my natural aesthetic instincts in a way that I'd not expected. And because the venue felt less demanding, performance anxiety was reduced to an absolute minimum. I'd never had so much fun. I also began to sense that I was becoming funnier. Of course, I may have been the first actor in history to have preferred being off Broadway to being on it, and I suspect this says a lot about my lack of performing ambition. For example, it never occurred to me to take lessons in acting or in singing or dancing. I did not view the world as an actor does, and I never thought of myself as one, although I certainly enjoyed getting laughs from the audience at Square East, but I saw no future in it. As far as fame was concerned, it never crossed my mind. I did not know where my life was taking me, and looking back, I seemed to be quite unconcerned about that. After all, I had a job waiting for me in BBC Radio, writing and producing, and if that went askew, I could always fall back on teaching. I certainly liked New York, and I loved the feeling of freedom it gave me. It's hard to explain, but I felt anonymous in a way that was completely liberating. Why had I not felt this in London? Nobody knew me there either, but there I seemed to carry some vague feeling of being watched, of needing to be on my best behaviour so that I would not be reported to whom. Perhaps it was just a lower middle-class anxiety about respectability, but it certainly vanished in New York. One morning, after I'd been in New York for a couple of months, I woke up in my hotel on Lexington Avenue and 48th Street, where I was paying $30 a week for my room, Worked out in the hotel gym, had a swim in the pool, and then wandered out to buy a New York Times to catch up on the world. I skimmed the front page, and something caught my eye, the date. It was Tuesday, the 27th of October, 1964. My birthday. I was 25. So I went off and had a lovely celebratory lunch at my favourite restaurant. I was perfectly happy to be on my own. While I enjoyed company, I didn't seem to need it, and I saw little of the Cambridge Circus team each day until we came together in the evenings to perform. When I did socialise, it was with people I'd met in New York, and two of them were to become very important in my life. The first was a management consultant called Nick Walt, whom I met at a party. He worked with the Boston Consulting Group, although he was from a different Boston in Lincolnshire. He was insanely polite and overbearingly considerate, and when you could trick him into talking about himself, he revealed an intriguing and offbeat way of looking at life, which included, for example, making graphs of his romantic relationships. When he analysed things, which was all the time, they took on an exponential complexity. I told him that if he wrote a report for the Boston Consulting Group about what he'd had for breakfast, it would come out resembling a Russian novel. But what I liked, indeed loved, about this man was that he was a passionate supporter of the Somerset County cricket team. Now, to conjure up genuine enthusiasm for the antics of such a comprehensively hopeless bunch of underdogs and ne'er-do-wells was hard enough for someone born and brought up in Somerset, but to choose them voluntarily, when there was absolutely no kind of geographical loyalty involved, was an act of such utter pointlessness that I felt rather in awe of Nick. I had been reading about existentialism. Here was someone living it, someone who accepted the concept of an act of free will in a meaningless universe and was taking it to a new level. Given Nick's take on the world, it was with some surprise that I learned that he was about to attend the Harvard Business School, but then I realised that, in a meaningless universe, going into business makes a lot of sense. When all values are in doubt, even Pascal might agree that making money is the best bet. I had, however, misunderstood Nick's motives. He was learning all the precepts of business so that he could turn his back on them. Having once described to me how Harvard taught him what a brilliant operation McDonald's was, with its universal standardization carefully eliminating any trace of individuality or spontaneity, he went and bought an artist's materials shop in London, L. Cornelison and Son, which he has run ever since. For anyone who's not yet got Nick's joke, I should explain that artist materials resist attempts to standardize them more strongly than any other products known to man. This pigment, called Russian Real White, is made in Vladivostok by frying the wings of the white admiral butterfly with mugwort pollen and ermine fur in an oil made by crushing a rare kind of gravel found only in the Bering Strait. This other white next to it, and apparently indistinguishable from it, is called Butterworth Raw White, which is a mixture of bleached Umbrian pasteurized talcum powder and fossilized Etruscan snow, baked in meerschaum clay over a mesquite grill, and then frozen for 12 years in a glacier. And this white, the shade of which is halfway between the whites already described, which is called not off-white, can only be obtained by importing it from mines on one of the outer moons of Neptune. So Nick, who has spent the last 40 years trying to systematize the storage of over 7 million of these pigments, has in fact merely been thumbing his nose at Harvard and its money-grubbing brush salesman culture. I think you can see why I love him. And there's another reason, too. I have to thank Nick for my first proper romantic relationship. Let me swiftly explain before you get the wrong idea. Early on in our friendship, Nick took me for lunch to a restaurant on Third Avenue called The Living Room. It was rather dark and loungy, but it offered a very good buffet. All you can eat, $3.49. As I was living on $15 a day, the place was a very useful find. But I couldn't get Nick to concentrate on our conversation because he kept glancing at and making admiring comments about my future bride. She was one of the waitresses, and eventually she came over to see if we needed more iced water and chatted briefly to us and went away, and I agreed with Nick that she was very charming and attractive, and then I agreed with him again, and then a third time, and then did my best to discourage him from proposing to her when she brought the check. However, a few days later, for a reason that now escapes me, I went back to the living room to splash out $3.49 on lunch and found myself chatting with Connie Booth again. I learned that all the waitresses there were looking for acting work. So we talked about theatre and I mentioned the show I was appearing in at Square East. And on my next visit, the following day, I took a book called Laughter by Henri Bergson because I thought I might impress her if she saw me reading a French philosopher. Remember, I was painfully naive. Finally, Nick and I had another lunch there together, and we invited Connie to see the Cambridge Circus show. The evening she came did not start well. The opening number of the show involved all the cast running out onto the stage and singing a jolly end-of-the-pier song. It's the end of the show. It's time now to go. We hope we brought you laughter and joy. So until we see you all again next year, it's goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. And then we all bowed and waved and left the stage, except for David Hatch, who stepped forward and said, well, as you can see, there'll be one or two changes in the running order of the show, which I always liked as a silly, upbeat way of getting things started. So Connie took one look at me as I stood there singing and dancing and, as I later learned, thought to herself in horror, oh, no, oh, God, he's terrible. And, of course, I was terrible, absolutely terrible, since I have no musical ability at all. Indeed, I was so aware of my ineptitude that the results of my natural lack of talent were made even worse by my acute self-consciousness about it. So, as I pranced around the stage like a wounded heron, Connie started making plans to escape the dinner that we had arranged for afterwards. Perhaps she could just disappear, leaving a note that her mother had been hit by a bus in Jakarta and that she didn't know when she would be back. Or perhaps she could feign an attack of lockjaw when we arrived at the dinner table. Anything, anything, to avoid the moment when she would have to make some comment about my performance skills. And then, as she sat there, enduring an agony of embarrassment, I reappeared on the stage to do a sketch with David Hatch, where I vetted him for a job with the Secret Service, and my battiness made her laugh a lot. And so everything was all right in the end, even though at dinner afterwards she hardly understood a word that Nick and I said because we talked so fast in our English accents. And so, with great decorousness, Connie and I started to see each other regularly. We loved talking together, and I think we both knew we might be in a serious relationship. I remember I was surprised to learn how much of Connie's time was taken up by auditions. In the 14 months since I'd left Cambridge, I'd never done one. So I was very amused when 2 weeks later I was asked to read for a role. Although the Cambridge Circus cast had been represented by a New York theatrical agency while we were on Broadway, we were sure that none of the agents really knew who we were. But one of them called and told me that I'd been invited to audition for a British show that was coming to Broadway in the new year, Half a Sixpence with Tommy Steele. I just laughed and laughed and felt I couldn't resist the idea that I could tell Bill and Tim that I was auditioning for a Broadway musical was going to be well worth the humiliation involved. Unlike Dudley Moore's one-legged man auditioning for the role of Tarzan, I was not expecting to land the job. So I went along to the theatre and hung around backstage until I was called, at which point I walked to the lighted part of the stage and gave my name. A stage manager joined me and we read out the 4 or 5 pages of dialogue that I'd been given when I'd arrived. I got a few laughs from the blackness in the orchestra's stalls because I was playing the part of a snooty upper-class English twit of the kind guaranteed to amuse Americans. And then I handed the pages back and a voice asked, "Could you sing something?" "No." This got a laugh. Pause. "Just sing anything." "I don't know anything. I cannot remember tunes." This was not quite true. I could remember tunes, I just couldn't sing them. But I was keen to end the audition as soon as possible. A pause, muttering in the stalls. Then, "Well, could you sing your national anthem?" "All right," I said. "How does it go?" This got a big laugh, but they persisted, and so I gave in and sang, "God Save the Queen." So appallingly, it should have been renamed "God Help the Queen." I went home giggling, and that night I rang Bill and Tim and told them that I'd auditioned and got the part, and they didn't believe me, although I swore it was true. And the next morning the agent called me to tell me I'd been given the role. The degree of my flabbergastedness beggars description. I was dumbfounded. My mind jammed. I had never even bothered to consider whether I wanted the job. "Don't you?" asked my agent. Look, it's $200 a week for 6 months if it runs, which it probably will. You rehearse here in New York and then do a few weeks in Boston and Toronto and then on to Broadway. "Hello? Your show at Washington Square closes in a few weeks, doesn't it? What are your plans?" I didn't want to admit that I didn't have any, and yes, it felt as though Cambridge Circus was winding down and didn't seem likely to be going far into the new year. "Have you ever been in a musical before?" No, not exactly." "Well, it'll be an interesting experience then." And that's what got me. True, it was only a very small part, and even someone as inexperienced as me could tell there was nothing very special about the writing. The show was adapted from H.G. Wells' novel Kipps, about an orphan working as an apprentice in a draper's shop who has a childhood sweetheart named Anne. By a stroke of good luck, Kipps comes into a fortune, and then falls for an upper-class girl whose brother, Walsingham, a stockbroker, possibly played by John Cleese, offers to take over the management of Kipps' money, swindles him, and disappears, leaving him a pauper again. Kipps now discovers that money isn't everything, and in a superb plot twist returns to his childhood sweetheart and marries her, and they live happily ever after. I learned all this from the script, which was sent to me when I made up my mind. I also met with a producer who told me that they'd heard that I was a writer and that if I cared to rewrite any of the dialogue, they would be very interested to see what I might come up with. I was rather excited and flattered by this, especially as I thought the ending could be made more interesting if, when Kipps and Anne returned from the wedding at the church, he dismembered her with an axe and invited all his old apprentices round for the barbecue. So I accepted the role, both for the experience and for the chance to help the writing, without worrying at all about its minuscule size. I discovered I had about 20 lines altogether, most of them spread over 4 group scenes in the first act, and the rest delivered in the first scene of the second act, which meant that I could then go down to my dressing room and read till I was required for the final bows. I'm amused that the Wikipedia entry for Half a Sixpence says that I played a small but crucial role. Small, I wouldn't argue with, but the crucial aspect of my role, the swindling and the absconding, took place in its entirety after I had left the stage and gone off to read. So I wouldn't claim much credit for it. With my future income now assured, but with several weeks to kill before rehearsals, I found myself working on a new version of Cambridge Circus. The two guys who ran Square East, Murray Swaig and Charles Rubin, both of whom we all liked very much, noticed the audience was falling off slightly and asked us if we could put on a new show with different material. Well, since Graham needed to resume his studies at St. Bartholomew's Hospital, and Joe Kendall and Johnny Lynn both wanted to get back to London, This suited us, and those of us who were left therefore started thinking about new sketches. I decided to try writing on my own and found it hard to get started because without Graham there to reassure me, I was uncertain whether what I was putting down was funny. But I stuck with it and began to come up with some material, which I got the others to assess when I went in to do the old show each evening. We also dug up some old skits from Cambridge days and kept a couple of numbers from the Broadway show, the Jones and Palin humour lecture, and the Beatles Hallelujah Chorus. After a while, we started rehearsing, and for the first time since we'd opened in London, some of us began to get a bit ratty with each other. Humphrey had done a terrific job moulding the original circus and then holding it together, but now I wanted more say in the shaping of the new show, as I was coming up with half of the material for it. But, on the other hand, he was still the director, and so the arguments went back and forth. Disagreements about the script were nothing new, and they were to persist through I'm Sorry I'll Read That Again, and at last the 1948 show, and the Python TV shows up to The Meaning of Life. But this was something slightly different. We'd been together for a long time, and when that happens, everyone starts to develop their own style, and sometimes the styles, which originally blended well, begin to diverge and produce genuine artistic differences. A phrase that people use to paper over far more serious conflicts, as when Emperor Hirohito described the attack on Pearl Harbor as being due to artistic differences with Franklin D. Roosevelt. That said, the squabbling never got too personal, and I continued to work with Humph over the next 35 years and planned to do a television series with him in 2017. The only other thing I can remember from the rehearsal period was that I started smoking. Menthols at first, but within a few months I was on the hard stuff, larks and parliaments. The new show opened in the middle of January 1965 without any kind of fanfare and got surprisingly good reviews in the New York papers. Jean Hart had come into the cast in place of Joe Kendall and she sang some jazzy numbers as well as funny ones. And Bill had written several new songs, so the musical side of the show was exceptionally strong. The buffoonery was largely in the hands of Tim, David and myself. I hugely enjoyed performing with these two because we'd been doing sketches long enough together to have developed a real comedic rapport. They had great timing and good energy, too, and were very generous, always thinking about the overall effect of a moment and not just about their own contribution. In one sketch, which we had great fun with, we played three top RAF officers who were briefing bomber crews for a raid over Germany during the war. Of course, it now occurs to me it might have been funnier if it had been set in peacetime. The theme was British inefficiency and unpreparedness. At one point, the crews were asked to consult their maps and instructed to fly over Gaul and drop their bombs just above the R of Holy Roman Empire. Watches are then synchronized with the words, "In exactly 5 seconds from now, it will be a few minutes after 10. In another skit, I played a BBC presenter who's carefully prepared his questions for an interview with a deep-sea diver. When he discovers that his interviewee is, in fact, an insurance salesman, he has to improvise. Here's a recording of the sketch that I made about 30 years later with Terry Jones.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Adventure. And this week we're going to have a look at deep sea diving. And here to tell us all about it is Mr. Albert Thomas. Now, Mr. Thomas, I understand you're a deep sea diver.
No, I'm an insurance agent.
You what?
I'm an insurance agent.
I had, as it were, been given to understand that you were, in fact, a deep sea diver.
Oh, no, no.
Yes, I see. Yes, have you ever been a deep-sea diver at any stage of your career?
No, nothing like that, no.
Fine, okay, well, we seem to have a few minutes left. So, would you mind if I asked you a few questions about selling insurance?
Oh, please, fire away.
Thank you. Tell me, what is the greatest depth at which you've ever worked?
Well, I should say about 12 feet, probably, sub-basement level.
12 feet?
Well, I never...
And, while you're selling insurance, do you wear any special apparatus, you know, like a nose clip, goggles, anything like that?
No.
tell me, Mr. Thomas, while you've been doing your insurance business, silly thing to ask, really, but have you ever been attacked by any large fish, you know, sharks, killer herrings, hammer-headed prawns?
No, nothing like that.
No, I see. Right.
I once trod on an orange.
What?
I once trod on an orange.
Really?
Yes.
You actually trod on an orange?
On an orange, yes.
Good heavens! Oh, dear, what a small world it is. Good Lord, fancy treading on an orange like that. Well, I know. I mean, you actually trod on it?
Yes, right on it.
What sort of an orange? This is absolutely fascinating. I mean, what sort of an orange was it that you trod on when you trod on it?
It was just an ordinary orange. That's all I trod on, yes.
Oh, well, now, at this stage, Mr. Thomas, we were going to ask you to sing a few traditional sea shanties. Do you have any traditional insuring shanties that you sing as you go insuring your way?
No, we don't have anything like that.
No, you don't. No. Well, why should you?
We also unearthed an old Footlights chestnut and were delighted when Gene Hart produced a powerful performance as Henry V, exhorting the English troops before the Battle of Agincourt. We followed her instructions to the letter. In peace, thus nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. And when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favoured rage. Tim's army, played by Tim, Bill, David, and me, were loyally obeying his orders, no matter what they were told to do. Then lend the eye a terrible aspect. Let it pry through the portage of the head like the brass cannon. Let the brow o'erwhelm it. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath and bend up every spirit to his full height. As we tottered off stage on tiptoe, I don't think anyone in the audience would have put money on the English army. One other sketch I recall with affection, David played the head keeper of a zoo where most of the animals have gone missing. Head keeper, and where are the giraffes? Assistant, well, they were all there on Friday, sir. Well, where are they now? Have they been stolen? Oh, no, sir, no. I think people just borrow them and forget to give them back. After about a month of the new show, we found that audiences were getting smaller again, and we all sensed that end of term was approaching. By now, I'd moved out of the Lexington Hotel and was staying with an old Footlights friend called Nick Ullett. He'd been a regular performer in the clubroom Smokers, singing his own songs to a guitar. And when he left Cambridge, he went to America, where he teamed up with Tony Hendra to form a successful comedy musical double act. By now, the two of them were making regular appearances on late-night talk shows, including Merv Griffin and especially Ed Sullivan. I'd reconnected with Nick through Tony, who'd been to our opening night on Broadway. Tony, you might remember, had been in the Footlights 1962 review with Graham, Tim, Humphrey and me. He was still slightly outrageous and formidably well-informed, with a thumb in many different writing pies. Nick had a quite roomy apartment at 10 West 65th, right next to Central Park and 2 minutes from Lincoln Circle. I remember sitting there with him at the end of January when we listened to Winston Churchill's funeral on the radio. By now, I'd been in New York for about 6 months, and I recall writing down the impressions I'd formed of the people. I've lost the original, but can reconstruct the gist. 1. America had what seemed to me an extraordinary reverence for anyone with lots of money. In England, to appear to be very interested in the old spondulics was, as I said earlier, considered vulgar and a sign of peasant ancestry. But in America, untrammeled money-grubbing was a way of life, nay, a raison d'etre. Furthermore, it didn't matter how the rich made their money. Waste disposal, trailer parks, sex toys, plastic forks, rubber doorstops, pornographic magazines, torture equipment, edible goldfish, mines, contraceptive sheaths, trading in widows and orphans. It just didn't matter. A journalist friend of mine lost his young wife to a chicken wire magnate. However your fortune was made, you had paramount status with just a whiff of moral superiority about it. You'd made it. Two, slightly different, though allied to this, success needed to be visible. Visitors to New York City wanted to see the theatrical hits. If you told them that you'd seen such and such a hit and that it was really rather dreary and predictable and crass and vacuous, but that there were two productions that nobody knew about that were brilliant and original and exciting, regretfully, they still wanted to see the hit. Three, New Yorkers weren't rude so much as tense. If I went into a tobacconist and started with my public school patter, I'm so sorry to bother you, but I'd rather care to buy some cigarettes, so if you'd be so good as to allow me to intrude upon your time, they'd shout, "What do you want?" as though you'd insulted them. But if you strode into the store, fixed them with a look of pure hatred, and hissed the word, "Larks," they'd smile and chat and tell you why they'd just left their wife. Now I turn my thoughts to half a sixpence. On the first day of rehearsal, I turned up very early and asked to speak to the musical director. My agent had assured me that the producers all understood about my lack of singing talent, but I wanted to clear the air with the man who mattered. Accordingly, I was led over to meet Stanley Lebowski. He was short and plump and pleasant, but he was clearly a busy man and had lots to do that day. "Mr. Lebowski, this is John Cleese. He wants to tell you something." "What can I do for you, John?" "Mr. Lebowski, Stanley. Stanley, I need to tell you something."
"What?"
"I can't sing." He laughed. "I told them at the audition, really, Stanley." He put a reassuring hand on my shoulder.
"John, let me tell you something. I've been working on Broadway for 40 years. Everybody can sing."
He took me over to a piano, hit a key, and asked me to sing the note. I did so to the best of my ability. I think for a moment he thought I was trying to make him laugh, but then he saw from my face that I was in earnest. He hit the key again, very deliberately. I made the same noise. He just stared. I think he quite genuinely could not believe his ears. He hit a different note. I made another noise. He looked a little shaken. Then he said,
"You're right. You can't sing."
"Sorry, Stanley."
"Never mind. Just learn the words and mime."
Because, of course, I was only in the chorus numbers, surrounded by trained singers, so who would ever know? I wandered back to the main room and was astonished to see just how many people had gathered. A Broadway musical requires a small army. Then I was taken over to meet the director, a dear little Texan who looked like a bush baby called Word Baker. For the next 2 weeks, rehearsals proceeded at a surprisingly gentle and undemanding pace. After all, I was in scenes solely for the purpose of explaining the plot. I had no big laughs to get, so as Noel Coward put it, my only requirements were to remember the lines and not fall over the furniture. I therefore became rather relaxed, except when I had to go and rehearse my one and only mime and dance routine, which opened the second act. The miming was no problem. The words were simple to learn. All I had to do was to ensure that I made no sound whatsoever. Because Stanley Lebowski could detect a fly clearing its throat at 50 paces. When, 3 months after the show opened, I had a rush of blood to the head and actually started singing quietly, pianissimo, at the bottom of my voice, I found him waiting for me as I emerged from the dressing room at the conclusion of the evening's entertainment.
"John," he said, "are you singing?"
To a passing backstage visitor, it must have seemed an odd accusation, but he'd caught me at it, fair and square. "Only a little bit, Stanley," I offered in extenuation. He looked me right in the eye.
"Don't."
So far as the dancing was concerned, my work needed work. This was the only choreography in the show that involved non-professional dancers, so I had high hopes there would be a couple of basket cases to keep me company. No such luck. The other actors had all clearly done this sort of thing before. I felt a flash of panic, imagining that on opening night I would stand out so badly from everyone else on stage that after the first few steps of the routine, I would have caught the audience's exclusive attention, and that they would then spend the rest of the number staring at my efforts, trying to work out what could possibly be wrong with me. So from that moment, I dedicated my waking hours to trying to narrow the gap between me and the next least talented dancer. The routine was based, unfortunately, on the polka, which involves leaping sideways at unpredictable intervals while moving in circles and smiling, as though this is an enjoyable experience. I gathered it was a Polish form of musical exercise, though what it had to do with dots, I never found out. Beads of cold sweat, maybe. I rehearsed my steps for hours with the help of an assistant choreographer, but I could never enact this strange Slavic routine with any kind of confidence. I would sometimes find myself polkering away for a few seconds quite fluently, but then the thought, "My God, I'm doing it," would flash into my brain, immediately creating a neurological interference pattern, which immediately transformed my prancing into an imitation of a man in battle, trying to avoid one of those chariots with nasty sharp knives sticking out of their wheels. The real trained dancers, fine athletes to a man and to a woman, were extraordinarily kind and patient and encouraging, even though I sometimes caught them watching me with the same fascination that people display the first time they see a duck-billed platypus. The only thing I didn't like about them was that when they themselves danced, they counted out loud the whole time, which I found very distracting. I didn't know why they were counting, and I was too embarrassed to ask what they were adding up. The number of steps they were dancing, perhaps? "I danced 50,112 steps today." "Hey, that's great. How many did you dance?" "Only 43,694, but I'm going to do another 7,000 after summer." A prima ballerina told me that dancers have very little conversation, except about dancing. So perhaps they were just practicing not talking about dancing. During this early rehearsal period, Word Baker would drop in now and again and make suggestions. I learned that he directed a long-running musical called The Fantastics, which had already lasted for 5 years off-Broadway. This continued playing until 2002, by which time it had set the world theatrical long-running record of 42 years. It was a very charming, sweet, and tuneful production, and the producers obviously believed that this flavour was just right for half a sixpence. The other person we saw regularly was our star and leader, Tommy Steele. He'd made his reputation as Britain's answer to Elvis Presley, and he proved a tremendously pleasant chap to work with, exuding an easy cheerfulness, Cockney elan, unfailing energy, and total informality that made running through scenes with him actually fun. It was okay to make a mistake, provided you learn from it. But his relaxed demeanor hid an unwavering commitment to making the show as good as it could be. And when he felt anyone was slacking or not fully concentrating, he could hand out a good ticking off, never losing his temper, but just telling people firmly and forcibly what they'd done wrong. It was interesting to me, with my lower middle class embarrassment about showing anger, that anyone who received a scolding from Tommy always felt it was fair. They were never resentful because it never became nasty. This aspect of Tommy's character was thoroughly helpful for the production. Provided one worked hard and remained focused, then a light-hearted approach was acceptable. This extended, incidentally, to the actual performances themselves. There was a moment quite early in the show when my character was first introduced to Tommy's Kips, and we shook hands. Now, this scene took place downstage of the front curtain, while stagehands behind it were arranging the set for the next scene, so there wasn't much room. And as I shook Tommy's hand, I had been directed to cross downstage of him. A couple of weeks into the show proper, as I was shaking his hand, he locked my wrists and gently propelled me towards the orchestra pit. This was only about 4 feet away. Of course, he didn't try very hard, but I found it particularly funny because he carried out his dastardly plan with that famous Cockney grin of his plastered across his stupid face. Such innocent glee at the prospect of damaging several musicians tickled me pink, and so this dicing with death routine became a regular part of the show. The audience had no idea what we were up to. If they ever had, it would have disappeared from the show forthwith. All in all, then, the first 2 weeks of rehearsal went smoothly, but when we arrived on the Monday of the third week, we were told that there had been a coup d'etat. Word Baker was gone, never to be seen again. In his place was Gene Sachs, an actor-turned-director, who told us that, so far as he was concerned, there was still a lot of work to be done, and that we'd better be getting on with it since we were opening in Boston in 2 weeks. We dispersed to the rehearsal rooms in a state of mild shock. At this point, I suddenly discovered I had a new mother. The first Mrs. Walsingham had been played, or rather rehearsed, by Charlotte Ray, a jolly, outgoing musical comedy trooper, but she'd now been replaced by Anne Shoemaker, a formidably grave figure who reminded me of a less feminine version of William Gladstone. Joining Charlotte and Word Baker in the outer darkness was the producer who'd wanted me to have a shot at rewriting some of the scenes, so that was the end of that idea. As someone remarked at this theatrical purge, in the beginning was Word, but only for a fortnight. Rehearsal now took on a slightly somber tone, partly because of a general anxiety that we didn't really know what was going on, partly because we all suspected that if we did make a joke, we would have to send Anne Shoemaker a written explanation for our misconduct. I learned she had been a Hollywood film actress for the last 30 years, so perhaps she regarded this musical comedy lark as a bit of a come-down. As the actress playing her daughter and my sister, Carrie Nye, remarked, apparently when you break the ice with Anne, there's an awful lot of cold water underneath. I liked Carrie enormously. She was a true Southern belle in real life with an astonishingly languid manner and a wicked dry sense of humour. She also happened to be married to Dick Cavett, who at that time had his own talk show, the wittiest and most intelligent one that I ever watched. I couldn't really understand what changes Gene Sachs was making to the show, because when big musicals are being rehearsed, the key elements are kept separate until the final stages. We had the dancers in one room, the singers in another, the actors out of earshot in the third, and Tommy Steele in all of them. Out of 11 song and dance routines, he was in 10. Mind you, the show had been specifically written as a vehicle for his talents, so he only had himself to blame. In the original London production, there were several numbers without him, none of which were as good as the ones he was in, so they were cut out of the Broadway show. Consequently, he was hardly ever off stage, for which, again, he only had himself to blame. How he found the energy, I shall never know, but he clearly loved what he was doing. So anyway, in this rather serious and uncertain atmosphere, we all travelled up to Boston, where we were opening at the Colonial Theatre in just 5 days. And this was when Gene Sachs started putting the show together for the first time. We all gathered in a proper theatre at last and started to run the show from the top, very haltingly as mistakes were made and corrected and unforeseen problems identified and discussed and transitions between scenes practised, and I was able to sit in the stalls and watch the songs and the dance numbers and picture in my mind how it was all going to look. And, of course, I was watching Gene Sachs like a hawk, seeing as how he had the power of life or death over me. Up to now, he'd been a rather remote figure. When he watched the dialogue scenes, he had made few comments, although I had the feeling he was rather put out that he had inherited me from my previous owner, when he would never have cast me in the first place. But he hadn't made any critical remarks, so I was not sure where I stood. Certainly, he seemed a rather formidable figure, tallish, strongly built, decisive, and not overburdened by any sense of fun. It never occurred to me that Half a Sixpence was only the third Broadway show he directed, that when he took it over it was an impending train wreck, that he had been given a paltry 15 days to sort it out, and that, like any other human being in his position, he must have been pretty fucking nervous. And I realised that I was getting nervous as my first scene was steadily approaching, when I had to walk out on stage and deliver a few lines towards Gene and some producers and cast who were scattered around the stalls. I was to make my entrance right after a big rambunctious song and dance called A Proper Gentleman, involving Tommy, all the apprentices, and all of the singers and dancers. The scene comprised a conversation with Mr. Shelford, the owner of the milliner's shop where Kipps worked as an apprentice. He was a tyrannical boss, played by Mercer MacLeod, an extraordinarily sweet and kind old actor who had been in show business for 50 years, but who had obviously undergone a dozen or so facelifts so that he resembled a very, very tall baby. He and I met in the wings and got ready for our entrance immediately after the knees-up Mother Brown routine ended. And it ends, and we walk out together, and I say my first line. "Ah, Shelford, I wonder if I might have a word with you. This business—" "Stop!" "It's Gene. Louder, John." "Oh, sorry." "Okay," we leave the stage. The dancers and singers have gone out front to watch Mercer and me re-enter, and I say loudly, "Ah, Shelford, I wonder if I might have a word—" "Louder!"
"Louder?"
"Yes, much louder."
"Much louder?"
"Yes! Again, please." I leave the stage bewildered. Last time was pretty loud, and now he wants it much louder than that. I'm getting a bit embarrassed, too. Enter Shelford and Walsingham, who says very loudly, as though he is a fairground barker, "Oh, Shelford, I wonder if I might have a word with you." Oh, that's the loudest I've ever spoken in my life. If I ever spoke like this in a restaurant, people would run for cover. Town criers would cower in submission. So I continue, "This business about louder."
"What? Louder than that?"
I suddenly begin to see red mist. Is this man insane? Why is he putting me through this ridiculous humiliation? Did the British hang his mother? So calmly, and with just a hint of mockery, "Louder than that, Mr. Sachs?"
"Yes!"
All right, my dander had been approaching the vertical for the last few seconds, and now it is right up. He wants it loud. Fine. He shall have it loud, then. I will try to create a sound wave that will damage him for the rest of his life. Frighten him to death will not be enough. I want blood to come out of his ears. I walk calmly off stage. I take a couple of deep breaths. I mutter to Shelford, "Turn away." And I walk back on stage, and with the sole intent of making Mr. Bloody Gene Sack say, with a deprecating laugh, "Oh, I didn't mean as loud as that," I scream, "Ah, Shelford! I wonder if I might have a word with you! Take that, you bastard, and die! I'm glad we burnt the White House down, you proud, crazed Yankee schmuck!" And I stand there breathing heavily and triumphant. And Gene calls out, "That's it!" Well, you could have knocked me down with one of those huge balls that are swung backwards and forwards from cranes to demolish buildings. I am so stunned, I forget the next line. "Once more, please." And the awful thing was, he was right. What Gene taught me about in 60 seconds was the vital importance of brute energy. The dance number Mercer and I had to follow was so noisy and exuberant and boisterous that had I spoken in a normal, loud voice, my presence would hardly have been detected by the audience. I had to find the same level of energy or the life would have drained out of the scene. Years later, when I was directing one of the Amnesty secret policeman shows, I had the same problem with any sketch that followed a stand-up comic. I had to put Ben Elton on at the end of the first half because he delivered his very funny routine into a hand mic at a half shout and with such a tact that any comedy performers coming on right after him to do normal sketch material didn't stand a chance, not even if they were Peter Cook. Only another stand-up could have survived, and then we would have had the same problem with the act after that. If I'd been smart enough to have enlisted more musical turns, I could have used them to drop the level of energy for the benefit of the next sketch, because music can accomplish this without feeling anticlimactic. So, after this right-angled learning curve, my life on stage became pleasantly straightforward. I only had to turn up half an hour before the show, deliver my infrequent lines, make sure I stayed out of the orchestra pit, avoid becoming too conspicuous during the polka, a feat I managed by the time we opened on Broadway, and retire to my dressing room to read Damon Runyon and Scott Fitzgerald and James Thurber.